Hi, everybody. Okay, now, Vishvadeva's book 6 of the Rig Veda, hymn 51. Sura marks well the doing of the pious, perhaps meaning that everything we see is under the... everything we do is being watched by the sun, perhaps. I praise you, guards of mighty law eternal, Ariti Varuna, Mitra Varuna, the noble Aryaman, Bhaga, all whose thoughts are faithful, hither I call the bright who share in common.
And the
Varuna is associated with the water. Just notice the idea of law occurring quite a few times, the law and the holy order. These are ideas which were precursors to the notion of Dhamma in Buddhism. Lords of the brave, infallible, foe destroyers, great kings, bestowers of fair homes to dwell in, young heroes, ruling heaven with strong dominion, Adityas. Aditi I seek with worship. Aditi is the mother of the Adityas. Aditya being a word for the sun, related to the notion of fire. For heaven our father is Dyas. Earth our guileless mother is Pratavi. O brother Agni and ye Vasus, bless us. Grant us, O Aditi and ye Adityas, all of one mind, your manifold protection. Give us not up to any evil creature as spoil to wolf or she-wolf. So this one's quite interesting, suggesting that the wolves were a danger for them at the time. O ye holy, for ye are they who guide aright our bodies. Ye are the rulers of our speech and vigour. Let us not suffer for the sins of others, nor do the deed which ye, O Vasus, punish. Ye, O universal gods, are all controllers. May he do harm unto himself who hates me. So here again, the kind of consensus, it's quite like the kind of the Lord's Prayer, isn't it? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Let not suffer for the sins of others. Mighty is homage. I adopt and use it. Homage hath held in place the earth and heaven. Homage to gods. Homage commands and rules them. I banish even committed sin by homage. Again, just to notice that when we're reading these translations, we use the word homage, and no doubt the fact that the homage is said to hold into place the earth and heaven suggests that it maybe is conceived as a somewhat different thing than we think of homage as. You furtherers of law, again the notion of law, so pure in your spirit, infallible dwellers in the home of order, to all heroes, mighty and far-seeing, bow me down, O holy ones, with homage. For these are they who shine with the noblest splendour. Through all our troubles, these conduct us safely. Varuna, Mitra, Agni, mighty rulers, true-minded, faithful to the hymn's controllers. May they, Earth, Aditi, Indra, Bhaga, Bhushan, increase our Lord, our fame, presumably, increase the fivefold people. I have no idea what that is. Maybe the castes, I'm not sure. Giving good help, good refuge, goodly guidance, may they be our good deliverers, good protectors. Come now, O gods, to your celestial station. The Bharadvaja's priest entreats your favour.
Of course, Bharadvaja
we met the other day. He, sacrificing fame for wealth, hath honoured the gods. What? Is that a word? Or is it a misprint? Love for those who sit and share oblations. Agni, drive thou the wicked foe, the evil-hearted thief, away. Far, far, Lord of the brave, I, and give us easy paths. A kind of suggestion of the travelling lifestyle here. Soma, you can almost imagine Agni, drive the evil-hearted thief away. Far, far, Lord of the brave, I, and give us easy paths. You can imagine like a nomadic people with their camp, yeah, and then lighting the fire in the camp to create a space of light and safety, keeping the thieves away. And some of these pressing stones have called aloud to Windy for our friend, destroy the evil Pani, for a wolf is he. Ye, O most bountiful, are they who, led by Indra, seek the sky. Again, this idea of like seeking the sky and the openness, give us good paths for travel, guard us well at home. Now have we entered on the road that leads to bliss without a foe, the road whereon a man escapes all enemies and gathers wealth. So this impression, this is just to give an idea of the kind of thing we're dealing with in the Vedas. We've got these verses which don't give us much in sort of in terms of concrete details of the lifestyle, but sort of quite evocative in terms of a spirit. You know, there's all through the Vedas you get this very positive, confident spirit. It's not at all kind of an introspective religion. It's very, you know, the gods give us wealth, and these are the proud young heroes, and they will conduct us safely, and all of these kinds of things. And also that thing of being on the road, so they're constantly on the road with the sky above them. And so wanting to escape from their enemies and gathering wealth. So this is why we get this kind of idea of the Aryans of this stage as being a nomadic people, with horse chariots moving around under the big open skies, possibly like memories of the more open lands in the northern regions, rather than the kind of closed Indian jungles. So this is, and just a few other things, just notice of course the variety of gods and goddesses that are being invoked here. Not necessarily any particular worked out system of hierarchy of the gods and goddesses and so on, but just sort of invoking all of them to come and help. Many of the gods which are invoked in the Rig Vedas, are already by the time of the Buddha have passed away. They're no longer heard in India already by that time. Others still part of the Hindu pantheon down to the present day, such as Indra. Okay, so that's just an introduction, and just to notice just once more that opening paragraph I think is quite important. You know, that mighty eye of Varuna and Mitra, infallible and dear, is moving upward. The pure and lovely face of holy order has shone like gold of heaven in its arising. So obviously the face shining like the gold of heaven, referring to the sun. And so this is the face of holy order, which presumably is Rita. And so this being one of the like almost like a reassurance of the good running of the universe, the cosmos is working properly, and the sun's there in the sky, it's bringing us light and heat, and I have the gratitude to that. And this being the quite emotional relationship to that, being a very strong precursor of this whole notion of order, yeah, and Rita, which comes down to us as the Dhamma. Okay. So I don't know what the fivefold people refers to. Yeah.
What does Mitra?
Mitra means friend. Mm. It's obviously one of the Vedic deities. I don't think they did name him. Did they? Did they? No. Five-footed. Five-spoked wheels. Five-footed. No. How many have we got those two? Five-fold, is it?
Yeah. Is this a different document, Bhante? Is it a different verse?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've seen that. Oops. Okay. Five-footed. I mean, he's five-footed. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is this still the same one?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, it says Earth Attitudes of Five Devas mentioned there. So perhaps they're regarded as five protectors of five different kinds of people or something like that. I'm not quite sure.
Or the followers of each, maybe?
Could be, yeah. Although, yeah, I don't know if they divided them up like that. But also to remember with this, it's very, very difficult to translate. Any attempt at translation is highly speculative. Yeah, very, very difficult. So, I mean, Griffiths did the best job that he could, but yeah, you really have to take this with a very, very serious grain of salt. Mm. Yeah. Okay, so...
In Sanskrit, what would you translate it from?
From Vedic Sanskrit.
Oh, so it's very archaic.
Let's have a look at it here. Our old friend Wikipedia. Vedic Sanskrit is an old Indic language, the language of the Vedas, the oldest Shruti texts of Hinduism. Could that be, could the focus be sharpened a little bit on that? Or was that just me?
It's on the outer rim.
Compiled over the period of the mid-second to first millennium BC, an archaic form of Sanskrit, an early descendant of Proto-Indo-Iranian. So it's between Proto-Indo-Iranian, i.e. between before the time when the Indians and the Iranians split up, up to and then an ancestor of Sanskrit and Pali, of course. Closely related to Avestan, the oldest preserved Iranian language. Vedic Sanskrit is the oldest attested language of the Indo-Iranian branch of the Indo-European family. From about 600 BC, in the classical period of Iron Age, ancient India, Vedic Sanskrit gave way to classical Sanskrit as defined by the grammar of Panini, of course that being a very gradual process. Vedic Sanskrit has been orally preserved as part of the oral Sharauta tradition of Vedic chanting. Linguists seek to restore the historical Vedic by identifying the few phonological changes that have crept into the language over the last four millennia.
So when they say Sanskrit, I thought Sanskrit is much later, so is this just a word they use?
Yeah, it's just a word they use. It's giving way over that period. That's too early for Panini. It should be more like 200-300 BC.
So you'd be best just to call it Vedic rather than Sanskrit.
Exactly, yeah. Vedic. It's not Sanskrit at all, actually. Sanskrit means artificial.
Yeah.
And so that's the name of the artificial constructed language of Panini. And so Vedic, it should really just be Vedic. Yeah. I don't know why they call it Vedic Sanskrit.
Because it creates a lot of confusion. And it's quite political, actually, the Sanskrit, especially in the Mahayana kind of doctrine.
Yeah.
Sanskrit's original and was the language of the upper class in the Buddhist time,
yeah.
And all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Is that true?
No.
Propaganda. Hindu propaganda.
And Chinese, and also Mahayana Buddhist propaganda.
Okay. Yeah, so hopefully by just going through some of the historical background, we can look at what we know about it rather than our own sort of ideas about these things. Okay, history of the Vedic language, just very quickly. Rig Veda contains many common Indo-Iranian elements in language and content that are not present in any other Vedic texts. This creation must have taken place over several centuries, and apart from the youngest books, 1 and 10... it must have been essentially complete by about 1200 BC. The Nausadiya hymn that we read was from the 10th chapter. Mantra language. In mantra and prose language is the Atharva Veda, the Rig Veda, blah, 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 various others, largely derived from the Rig Veda, but a few changes. Notably, Vishva has changed to Sarva. The verse we had before was the Vishva Devas. So then it tends to change to sarva for all, which is the form used in Pali, sabba. Okay, so this is corresponds to the Iron Age and to the kingdom of the Kurus, dating from the 12th century BC.
Where is that?
Near Delhi. That's the period of the legendary period of the Mahabharata.
So what do the scholars have to work with, like printed texts?
No. We'll have a look more of that later. Yeah, we just moved on to here because we got the question about the language, so we moved into here. We'll just gradually move around the different topics. So just have a look at the language for now. Samhita prose.
But so I was talking about language. I mean, when you're talking about the language, you're talking about the spoken language.
Yeah. No, you're talking about... again, we'll talk about the history of the text a bit later on, yeah? So for now, just having a look at the different forms of it. Gradually, then you have... These are all verses. First prose, strata, Samhita prose. Brahmana prose and the early Upanishads. So this is the period just before the Buddha and the Sutra language. Of course, from the Brahmanical Sutras later. Okay.
I can't read that.
Don't worry about it. It's too much information. We don't want to go into all of these kinds of things. So this is the just treating some of the features of Vedic Sanskrit, a couple of sounds which are not lacking in later languages, and a pitch accent. And possibly marginally a tonal language, which have got lost in later languages, but still has an effect in terms of the verse forms. So these are just some more grammatical details for the grammar junkies. Okay, so now we'll just have an overview of the Vedic period. We're actually going to do something before that. Proto-Indo-European religion. Have a look, bit of a look at the Proto-Indo-European stuff first. The interesting thing when we're considering or reconstructing ancient Indian history, we had a look last week at the Indus Valley. And what you have with the Indus Valley is basically bricks and stuff made of pottery and rock and stone, which and you have these images on those things, but the images themselves are very enigmatic. We don't know what they mean. We don't know what they meant to those people. And they have a language, they have a script, but the script, we can't hear it. Yeah, we can't communicate with any language. And with the Vedic civilization, you have almost a completely the opposite situation, where you have no archaeological record at all, as far as I'm aware. We might find there might be a few things mentioned in here, but pretty much there's no major archaeological record of the whole period, right, between the Indus Valley and Ashoka. The archaeological record in India is pretty much a complete blank. Okay, so there's very little. Now we might have to qualify that. If we have a look around, we might find some things, but generally that's the case. So all we have is these verses. We have a set of hymns. We've already seen one of the hymns that's come down to us, and it's difficult to draw too much conclusions about the nature of the society and so on from those kinds of hymns. We're reduced to guesses and inferences. So you've almost like got this voiceless rock on one hand, and then just this pure language on the other.
What
year
was it used?
Sorry?
What
year
was it
used? Usually ending about 2000 BC or so.
That's when
they came up the season. Yeah. So sort of gradually evolving, reaching its peak about 3,000 BC, and gradually declining to the second millennium BC. Yeah. So, okay. So let's just have a bit. It's generally believed that the Indus Valley civilization arose from the indigenous Indians with contact with people in the Iranian area, the Mesopotamian or Sumerian regions, and that the Aryans, or now called the Proto-Indo-Europeans, after Hitler you can't call them Aryans anymore, were late moved into India. They're called Pies. They moved into India later. Okay, and so the question of the relationship between those two things are controversial. Proto-Indo-Europeans were the speakers of the Proto-Indo-European language. So notice that we're inferring a people from a language. We're inferring a language from the similarities of existing languages.
Yeah.
Okay?
Because it's a test of whether that's really the language, you know, it's quite artificial.
It is, yeah, Proto-Indo-European is very artificial. Likely lived around 4000 BC during the Copper Age and the Bronze Age, or possibly earlier during the Neolithic or Paleolithic eras. Knowledge of them comes chiefly from the reconstruction of their language, which was the ancestor of the Indo-European languages, including English, and actually including English, or most European languages apart from Finno-Hungarian. Their genetics and phenotypes are a subject of speculation. Evidence for Proto-Europeans are defined as the people who spoke the reconstructed Proto-Indo-European language. The basic information arises out of comparative linguistics. So we try to deduce from the languages and compare with studies in archaeology and genetics. Okay, so it's not a straightforward matter by any means. Comparative linguistics, but based on the reconstructed Proto-Indo-European language, some things about their culture can be determined with confidence. They use a kinship system based on relationships between men, so that's important anthropological data. They worshipped a sky god, Dias, sky father, which is the ancestor of Zeus, Jupiter. They knew transportation by or across water. They practiced agriculture and cultivated cereals and attested a technology commonly ascribed to early farming communities. They composed and recited heroic poetry, such as we've just seen, or song lyrics that use stock phrases like imperishable fame. The climate they lived in had snow. Stock breeding and animal husbandry were important to their economy, and their animals included domesticated cattle and horses. They domesticated the horse, equus, this is Sanskrit ashva, cognate with English horse, the cow, guaus, which is Sewa word for cow, ko in Thai, played a central role in religion and mythology as well as daily life. A man's wealth would have been measured by the number of his animals. It was pecus, see it in English, fi pecunia, there you go. They had knowledge of the domestic dog. They knew the wheel and had carts with solid wheels, but not yet chariots with spoked wheels. Anyway. What is known about Proto-Indo-Europeans with any certainty is the result of comparative linguistics, partly supported by agriculture, patrilinear, semi-nomadic, polytheistic religion centered on sacrificial rites, probably administered by a priestly caste. Burials in barrows or tomb chambers apply to the Kurgan culture. And so these are different hypotheses about the origins of the Proto-Indo-Europeans. Kurgan hypothesis is one. Or a theory about where they came from. Important leaders would have been buried with their belongings in Kurgans and possibly also with members of their household or wives. I believe Kurgan hypothesis says that they're born in the pit grave culture in the Pontic steppe. Okay, so this is looking at this being the homeland of the Proto-Indo-Europeans. According to the Kurgan model, it's the most widely accepted scenario.
So, Indo-European is a cognate with Aryan.
Yeah, it's more the politically correct word for Aryan. Yeah. Post-Hitler. So that gives you an idea of the spread and where they started from.
How come does it extend all the way to Western Europe?
To where?
To Western Europe.
That's good. That's probably a date. From 4000 to 1000 BC. So presumably by 1000 BC, still looks a bit pessimistic. I would have thought by 1000 BC that there was, certainly through England and Europe, there's the Celtic called Celts and so on, which is an Aryan people, Indo-European people. Yeah. All right. So it's just one theory of their origins. There is evidence for sacred kingship, suggesting the tribal king at the same time assumed the role of a high priest. Possibly where their important leaders would have been buried in Kogans, possibly also with members of their households or wives, human sacrifice and sati. Many Indo-European societies know a threefold division of priests, a warrior class, and a class of peasants or husbandmen. Such a division was suggested for the Proto-Indo-European society by George de Maizière. If there had been a separate class of warriors, it would probably have consisted of single young men. They would have followed a separate warrior code unacceptable in society outside their peer group. Traces of initiation rites in several Indo-European societies suggest that this group identified itself with wolves or dogs. See also berserker, werewolf. That's interesting. Especially with the last verse we read, protect us from the wolves. The young blokes had a bit too much soma and they're getting a bit excited. Technologically, reconstruction suggests a culture of the early Bronze Age. Bronze tools and weapons, silver and gold were known. Sheep were kept for wool and weaving was practiced. The wheel was known. And later on, maybe horse-drawn chariots. So the designation Aryo is attested only within the Indo-Iranian subfamily. So it's not sure what they called themselves, or indeed if they even had one single name for themselves. Chronology, blah, 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 the origin of Indo-European go back 500 years on linguistic grounds. Glottochronology, yeah. Glottochronology is a statistical linguistic method which tries to deduce the relative age of languages by making assumptions about the rate of change of the language. So you can compare how much two languages have diverged and then sort of trace that back and infer how far away they diverged. And of course this being a very controversial technique, because we don't know how quickly languages might evolve in different circumstances. Archaeology, there have been many attempts to claim that particular prehistoric cultures can be identified with the primitive Indo-European speaking peoples, but all have been speculative. All attempts to identify an actual people with an unattested language depend on a sound reconstruction of that language that allows identification of cultural concepts and environmental factors which may be associated with particular cultures, such as the use of metals, agriculture versus pastoralism, blah, blah, blah. And in the 20th century, Marija Gimbutas, who's living in America, anthropologist, passed away a few years ago and was either famous or notorious for her theories of the ancient matriarchal cultures of Europe. She created the Kurgan hypothesis, a modern variation of the traditional invasion theory, named after the Kurgans in the Eurasian steppes. The hypothesis is that the Indo-Europeans were a nomadic tribe of the Pontic-Caspian steppe, now eastern Ukraine and southern Russia, and expanded in several ways during the 3rd millennium BC, coinciding with the taming of the horse. Leaving archaeological signs of their presence, see battle axe people, they subjugated the peaceful European Neolithic farmers of Gimbutas's old Europe. As Gimbutas's beliefs evolved, she put increasing emphasis on the patriarchal, patrilinear nature of the invading culture, sharply contrasting it with the supposedly egalitarian, if not matrilinear culture of the invaded, to a point of formulating essentially feminist archaeology. Her theory has So she's very, very controversial. She actually did tremendous amount of foundational archaeological work, especially in Europe, and so was one of the great archaeologists and studying that area. But her sort of quite polemical interpretations, of course, have been very controversial. The theory's found genetic support in remains from the Neolithic culture of Scandinavia, where bone remains in Neolithic graves indicated that the megalithic culture was either matrilocal or matrilinear, as the people buried in the same grave were related through the women. Likewise, there's evidence of remaining matrilineal traditions among the Picts. A modified form of this theory by J.P. Mallory, dating the migrations earlier to around 4000 BC and putting less insistence on their violent or quasi-military nature, is still widely heard. Okay, so an alternative theory, the Anatolian hypothesis. Indo-European languages spread peacefully into Europe from Asia Minor with the advance of around 7000 BC, with the advance of farming. Leading propagator of the theory is Colin Renfrew. This theory is contradicted by the fact that ancient Anatolia is known to be inhabited by non-Indo-European, namely the Hattians, Kalib and Kaldi. Also the culture of Indo-Europeans, as inferred by linguistic reconstruction, contradicts this theory. Okay, so another theory, the Black Sea Deluge theory, hypothesized submersion of the northeast part of the Black Sea around 5600 BC, and so on. So different speculations, really. No agreement there. Rise of archaeogenetic evidence, which uses genetic analysis to trace migration patterns, also added new elements to the puzzle. So like in the 19th century, the kind of the faddish science was linguistics. So you could trace sort of through linguistic roots and sort of hopefully go back in time to trace the roots of the languages and the connections between them. And now it's genetics. So that they sample the DNA from people in different areas and then try to trace them back. It's clear that genetically speaking, peoples of the Kurgan steppe descend at least in part from people of the Middle East and Neolithic who immigrated there from Turkey. Okay. So
Anatolia, that country, doesn't exist now, is Turkey. Anatolia in the northern part of Turkey.
Yeah, so I guess the difference is whether it originated from here or from here. So I guess looking at that, if I think the intensity of that particular genetic marker, so it tends to indicate this kind of the centre around here or something. And of course, it being very complex, you can't, the shift of genes isn't necessarily the same thing as the shift of languages. Just for example, in Australia, you had a wide-scale shift of arrival of people from all different backgrounds, and so the genetic pool of Australia no doubt has changed a lot, say in the last generation or two, but the Australian language has not changed all that much as a result of that. Probably changed more because of other factors. Anyway, so so that's enough to just give you an idea of the landscape there as far as language goes. Proto-Indo-European society. So we've already read most of those things. Animal husbandry, horse, ritual and sacrifice. Animals were slaughtered and dedicated to the gods in the hope of winning their favour. The king, as the high priest, would have been the central figure in establishing favourable relations with the other world. Okay. Patronomics commonly found. So And so this is the word I was referring to before, the rita, fitting, right, ordered, right time, ritually correct, the order of the world, the Western Asha, Vedic Ritu, Rita Ritu. Come across for kids. This identification is a tempo. Okay. So, put it in the language we've seen, put it in the European peoples. Okay, so Proto-Indo-European religion, and so just to have a look at some of the details, again all reconstructed ideas of their religion. Some of the proposed deities are more readily accepted among scholars than others. Deus Peter, I'm not sure, I don't know how to pronounce the markers there, is god of the daylit sky and the chief god of the Indo-European pantheon. In Greek, Zeus, vocative form Zupata, Latin Jupiter, Dispata, Sanskrit Dias Vita. Deus, Deva or Deus, is Greek Dios, god, and so on. Jove, a particular god, Deus, Divus, Sanskrit, Deva. Avestan Devas were demonized by Zarathustra. So in India, the Asuras are the bad guys and the Devas are the good guys, whereas in Iran, the Devas are the bad guys and the Asuras are the good guys. Devas, so on and so forth. This one, Pratavi or something, plenty, is the goddess of wide flat lands and the rivers that meander across them. And in Sanskrit, Pratavi is the earth, from the ancient Persian, the Euphrates River. Perkunos, the striker, from Sanskrit, Parjanya, Lithuanian, Latvian, Slavic, Norse, so on. It's a god that goes his name to Thursday. This one, somebody would like to pronounce that for me, I'll be very happy. Thanks for that. The name of certain specific gods, usually the sun, the stars, especially the planet Venus or hearth fires, a class of gods, those that shine with golden light, and a general word for a god, any god. General, the goddess of dawn, Eos, Aurora, Vedic, Ushas. But later demonized as Ashura, demon. Ahura Mazda, the good god of the Zoroastrians, Ahura, Lithuanian mythology, and so on. Goddess of dawn. Sun is in the other one, it comes down to Hestia, the goddess of the hearth. Istara, Vesta, sorry? And then Tara, yeah. So Tara is related to Hestia, I didn't know that. Vesta. And Priha, beloved or friend, Sanskrit Priya, the love goddess. She's known in Hittite as the object of the Puruli festival. Avestan Paura, placed by Anahita, Greek, is recognized as Aphrodite. Latin Venus takes her place, whose name corresponds to Vanus or lust, an epithet of Ushas. So in that thing then, Nirvana means no Venus. In Albanian Perendi, Saint Perendi, the ego becomes a saint. Priya. Grim refers to an old Bohemian form, Priya, as a gloss for Aphrodite, the fifth day of the week. We come down to elves. River goddess Denu, Danu, Irish Danu. So on the Dan rivers, what are the names? Wellness, cattle god. Divine twins, which may or may not be related. Sun, moon, Yama and Manu. The horse twins. What's the Ashvins in Sanskrit? Daiskuri. And various other kinds of Hindu twins. Water and sea god, Neptune. And so on, the sun and the moon. Sun is Surya, Helios, Sol. So on, the moon gives a Vestan, Mare, Ma.
I think one of the two may be an A-E. You know those A-E joined together?
Maybe. No, I'm not sure. Maybe there's different H's. I think there might be different H's, like an ordinary H and a guttural H or something like that.
Huh.
I don't know. Then a set of nature gods, pastoral god, and form three fate goddesses, the Norns, and so on. Okay. Pandemonium, mutual demonization. Okay. And also moving to mythology, a belief in a world tree, the Ash Yggdrasil in Norse, Hinduism the Banyan tree, of course saying the Bodhi tree, Lithuanian mythology and the oak tree, hazel in Celtic. The slaying of the serpent, usually a dragon of some kind. So all these different versions of the dragon slaying, Indra versus Vitra, in the Rig Veda being the most fundamental for the Indic thing. Dragon slaying sun in the rock myth. This one's very common in the Rig Veda. The releasing of the sun from the rock. Can be interpreted in many ways, but the most basic way is just that it's what happens at dawn. Yeah? The sun is released from the rock. Okay, so the earth created from the bones of a god, brothers. Various kinds of brothers, brothers, myths, creation myths, and so on. And so there's some examples of their religious vocabulary: to pray, holy, speak solemnly, call, invoke, consecrate, and so on. So that's just some ideas.
How many words?
Explaining it down there.
Is that trying to?
It's just the transliteration system for primitive Indo-European. So. Right.
But you know, where do those words come from?
So it's H1, H2.
Okay, they are reconstructed words which are reconstructed by linguists in the primitive Indo-European language.
So they sort of infer them from
inferred forms,
how they are used nowadays in the languages.
Yeah, not so much how they're used nowadays, but how they are used in the ancient languages. Yeah, in the earliest phase of the theory of the Indo-European languages was proposed by Max Müller, and in those days it was believed that there was fairly not too dissimilar from Vedic Sanskrit, and so that the postulated Indo-European was based largely on Vedic, on the Vedic language. Since then, there's been a progressive move away from the Vedic language, and they keep on doing that. So, just down here, relationships to other language families, blah blah blah, consonants. So here's giving the forms here, so the fricatives and blah 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 blah. So these are, they're just diacritical marks for the various.
And is derived from any kind of text?
No. It's all in fact, even the Vedas, you don't have texts. Right? I mean, the Vedas, you've got texts which are 400 years old for an actual poem which is perhaps 4,000 years old. So all of this is just inferred. The primitive European doesn't exist anywhere. Yeah. So it's entirely inferred from comparing ancient languages and reconstructing that with using principles of linguistics. So very that's pretty cool, isn't it? Oh yeah, it's a whole field, and it's great. It's a fantastic scholarly field because nobody knows anything.
And nobody can disprove.
You can make up whatever you like.
It's terrific. And here, I mean, let's see, Anatolian, Indo-European goes to Anatolian there.
Where's the Atlantic language? But
Anatolian, Indo-Iranian, Indo-Aryan, Hellenic, Aeolic, Achaean, Latin, and then the Romans, blah blah blah. It's often the Celtic, blah blah blah. British, Briton, Cornish, revived Cornish. Gallo-Rattan, Iberian, Gallic. It's great, isn't it?
Are these musical band names?
They could be. Afrikaans down there. Dutch, Flemish. Swiss German.
Oh, baby.
What's the green and the red?
Swiss German's down here.
Is it spoken in there?
I'm not sure. Possibly. Because these are all. Possibly, I'm not sure.
Yeah, five Swiss.
Arshti, Gandhari. Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, Bhagavad Gita is much later. So Bhagavad Gita, you're talking maybe 200 AD, something like that. So like 600-700 years after the Buddha. So then that would be 2,000 or 3,000 years after the Rig Veda. So that's, and within the Bhagavad Gita, you have a very kind of complex discussion, very philosophically sophisticated discussion of all the different philosophical systems that were around at the time. So it's quite an advanced. Quite different from the Vedic stuff. Yeah. So anyway, it gives you an idea of the potential for an academic career in the field. I think one of Adi's teachers was an expert in primitive Indo-European, Proto-Indo-European. So, okay. So moving from there, so we're now following the Aryan peoples into into India, and so we're back now here to the Vedic Sanskrit language, and I would just like just to have a look at the grammar. And just in case for anyone who's been studying Pali grammar, we just rejoice in all of the things that are not there compared to Vedic grammar. Three synthetic past tenses, imperfect, perfect, and aorist, and a fifth mood, the injunctive, distinguished semantically. Long I stem, stems differentiated, subjunctive mood is lost in classical Sanskrit. More than 12 ways of forming infinitives, of which classical Sanskrit retained only one form. Even though we might think that Pali is a bit much grammatically, but compared to Vedic, it's a piece of cake. Right.
So, is there a linguistic trend over time towards a simplification and
more efficient use of grammar?
Yeah, yeah. Check out the book, The Unfolding of Language. Mm-hmm. Look at that. It's really good. Talks about that. Yeah, it's terrific. And that, those things are formulated in terms of specific linguistic laws, most famous of which is called Grimm's Laws. And that the language tends to evolve in certain specific ways. There's certain specific phonetic changes that tend to get made, which will cause language to kind of wear away. But at the same time, there are also creative forces that are adding complexity in other ways. Yeah? So you've got on one hand, old things are wearing away, on the other hand, there's new forces that are creating.
So that kind of makes sense in the way that, like, when you're trying to do something for the first time, everyone comes up with a different idea about how to do it. And then over time, they kind of get together and say, this works better.
And you can also just see that in living English, particularly if you listen to how people use, say, Chinglish, where you'd say the difference between he and she starts to drop away, and use of tenses starts to fall away. And so that's exactly what tends to happen, and that's the direction English will move in the future. Yeah. Okay. The Vedic period or Vedic age is a period in which the Vedas, the oldest sacred texts of Indo-Iranians, were being composed. Scholars place the Vedic period in the 2nd and 1st millennium BCE, continuing up to the 2nd century BCE, based on literary evidence. Okay, so here we're talking about internal evidence of the texts themselves, lacking archaeological evidence. Here's a general map of the area. So notice that centred around the Kuru Panchala area, sort of a tendency to move the Indian cultural centre to move further east. In the Indus Valley time, it was centred up here. Now we're kind of centred down here, Kuru, and so on. And of course, by the time of the Buddha and in the Shokan time, it was down in Magadha.
Do you mean the west of Pantai?
Sorry?
Is that west?
What?
The Kuru countries in the west?
West relative to the. It was moving east from Indus Valley to Kuru down to here. Okay.
I think why there's several
archaeological
evidence of, given that we've got all this stuff
from the Harappa. Yeah, it's a mystery. There's nothing there.
Is it just sitting underneath big Indian cities, no one's bothered to dig it up?
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, to put it into context, in Patna, which was Pataliputta, which was the Rome of ancient India, probably bigger than Rome in most of its periods. It was a vast metropolis, which was the capital of all of India. There's not been one single properly documented archaeological excavation ever.
And now
there's a huge modern city built on top of it.
Yeah.
And they go out there with D4 bulldozers,
yeah,
and just plough up all this stuff when they're building new suburbs.
Yeah.
It just seems a bit weird that there's this huge field of linguistics and obviously funding going into that, and no parallel funding going into this being up like that.
Yeah.
They do some.
There is some work. There is an Indian Archaeological Society, and they try to do something. But it's more than that. It's more than just the absence of funds. It's also to do with the nature of the culture, and in particular, quite possibly, the nature of the building materials. They probably built everything out of wood.
And they had lots of floods on.
Yeah, I mean, even wood survived. You know, there's still wood from Ashoka's time. There's even one, I'm not sure if it's accepted or not, but there's one wooden sculpture, goddess sculpture, which is supposed to be from the Indus Valley. Seems very old wood. But anyway, let's have a look through and see if they discuss that more. But that's my understanding at the moment, is that there's no material remains, and probably the reason is because of the perishability of the materials.
Is that remember, do you remember when they dug the bell?
Yeah.
They were digging the posts to put this bell in it, but dying in the process of digging just 4 posts, and they recovered, how many? So 37 or something statues.
3 images, yeah.
Just by digging 4
so
posts you can't ground for the belly.
That's different. That's in Bodh Gaya, yeah? So these are much later Buddha images, stone Buddha images. But yeah, in Bodh Gaya you can't put a spade in the ground without digging up things. Yeah. And you know, he showed to the caretaker, you know, the guy's responsible. What do we do with this? I said, I'll just take him home. It's just too much stuff. They can't put it all in museums and things. Yeah. Okay. Associated culture, sometimes referred to as Vedic civilization, was centered in the northern and northwestern parts of the Indian subcontinent. Its early phase saw the formation of various kingdoms of ancient India. In its late phase, it saw the rise of the Mahajanapadas, which is the great countries. It's basically the nation system which we've found in the Pali Canon, and was succeeded by the Maurya Empire, the Golden Age, the classical age of Sanskrit literature, and the Middle Kingdoms of India. Overview. Reconstruction of the history of Vedic India is based on text internal details. Okay, linguistic five strata. We've already looked at most of this before. The oldest one is the Rig Veda. Archaeologically, this period may correspond with the Gandhara grave culture, the cemetery age culture of the Punjab, and the ochre-coloured pottery culture further east. There's no widely accepted archaeological or linguistic evidence of direct cultural continuity from the Indus Valley civilization. Mantra language. This period includes both the mantra and prose language of the Atharva Veda, the Rig Veda Kilani, and the Samaveda Samhita. And mantras of the Yajur Veda. Okay, so a few changes. This is the time of the early Iron Age in northwestern India, corresponding to the black and red ware culture. So we'll have a look at that. And the kingdom of the Kurus, from about 10th century BCE. Samhita prose, the collection and modification of the Vedic canon. An important linguistic change is the complete loss of the injunctive Brahmana. Commentary on mantras and ritual of the black Yajur Veda belongs to this period. Archaeologically, the painted greyware culture from about 960 BC shifted the political centre from the Kurus to the Panchalas on the Ganges, again moving gradually further east. Brahmana prose, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, and the Upanishads. Okay, so these are post-Vedic texts. Which deal with ritual and so on, and the Upanishads, of course, being philosophical texts.
Were all of these texts looked after by the Brahmins? They were
memorized
and
by them.
Guarded, and they were the ones that they kept and sort of didn't find.
Absolutely, yeah. They said if a sutra overhears the reciting of the Vedas, then he should have molten lead poured in his ears.
Huh?
And if he recites it, he should have his tongue cut out. The sudras, like the non Brahmins, the lower caste people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then the sutra language, and the language of the Mahabharata and Ramayana, classical Sanskrit, post-Vedic period. So all of these texts give us some information about the Vedic period. Okay, and of course, the further you get on, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana are set in that period. Okay, so they're telling stories about that period, about the Kuru kingdom and all of these kinds of things. But the versions we have of Mahabharata and Ramayana, of course, millennia later, at least a millennia later, and composed over a very long period. So all of these texts, like the Buddhist texts, are composed by putting together, gradually adding bits and building them up over a long period. So it's, you know, the Mahabharata quite probably contains some information which is accurate for the earlier period, but it's very difficult to tell exactly what is accurate. Okay. Invasion of Darius I of the Indus Valley in early 6th century BCE marks the beginning of outside influence, continued, I don't know about the beginning of outside influence, but anyway, continued in the kingdoms of the Indo-Greeks, new ways of immigration, blah, 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 and ultimately the Islamic Sultans, Rig Vedic period. The origin of the Vedic civilization is relation to the Indus-Valley civilization, Indo-Aryan migration, and the Gandhara grave culture related cultures remains controversial and politically charged in Indian society, often leading to disputes on the history of Vedic culture. The Rig Veda is primarily a collection of religious hymns and allusions to, but not explanation of, various myths and stories, particularly in the younger books 1 and 10. The oldest hymns, probably in books 2 to 7, as some hold book 9, the Soma Mandala, to be even more ancient, contain many elements derived from pre-Vedic common Indo-Iranian society. It's difficult to define the precise beginning of the Rig Vedic period as it emerges seamlessly from the era preceding it. Also, due to the semi-nomadic nature of the society described, it cannot be easily localized, and in its earliest phase describes tribes that were essentially on the move. Rig Vedic Aryans have a lot in common with the Andranovo culture and the Mitanni kingdoms, as well as with early Iranians. Andranovo culture, I don't know what that is.
In contemporary India, the Brahmin caste, do they still sort of retain that caste stewardship or whatever of the rituals?
The Brahmins, yeah.
And is it incredibly different from the old? From the Vedic?
Yeah, they've preserved the texts. See, they preserve all the texts and so on down.
So but they were still so Brahmins would still memorise a lot of those texts.
There were still Brahmins who memorised the Rig Vedas, yeah. But the actual religious practices has changed tremendously. And of course, within a religious culture, there's not a perception of that change.
Yeah, I see it.
Just as within the Christian society, you know, Jesus said, if you want to follow me, give away everything you've got, you know, throw away all your possessions and come and follow me. And of course, it's not that.
Yeah.
You actually find that in modern Christianity, but the Christians themselves typically don't see the contradiction. So the same thing within the Hindu society, yeah. It wouldn't be a secret now because it's all published, yeah.
Yeah,
anyone who wants the information can get it. Yeah. It's much more difficult to keep it secret as soon as you start writing it down.
Yeah,
that was actually one of the main motivations for not writing it down.
Right.
And that's one of the main reasons why it was the Buddhists, not the Hindus, who introduced writing for religious texts.
Right.
Yeah, that's actually a critical point. Yeah. The Buddhists didn't want to keep their text secret, so they didn't mind if you write it down. Once you've written it down, it sits somewhere and somebody can come along and pick it up and read it.
Mm.
If you have to recite it, then you know who you're reciting to, so you can control it much more easily.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so just a few points of the old political organisation. The Grama, I wonder if that's related to the Gama, the town, possibly. Vis and Jana were political units. A Vish was the subdivision of a Jana, and a Grama was a smaller unit. The leader of a Grama was called a Gramani. It's a term that's still found in the Sanghita, the Gamani Sanghita. And a Vish was Vishpati. The Rashtra, polity, was governed by a Rajan, chief or king. Kings often referred to as a Gopa, protector of cows. Yeah, same thing. Rashtra, Ratta, as in Rattapala. And occasionally a Samrat. He governed the people with their consent and approval. I'm not sure if the people would always agree with that, but in theory anyway. He was elected from a strict, restricted class of royals, the Rajanya. There was various types of meetings, such as, it's interesting, just note in passing, you have this word for Mahapajapatis described as being the foremost in Ratanyu, which is usually understood as being knowing many knights and being the senior most in the Sangha, but K.R. Norman makes a linguistic argument that the word actually derives from this word, Rajanya, and so it perhaps originally meant that she was the first in those who had gone forth from a royal family. There were various types of meetings, such as the Vidhata or Sabha, Sabha being still the name for the Indian Congress, Gana, not the same word as the Australian word, Gana. It was the first non-monarchical assembly. It's a parallel one to the monarchical assemblies of the period headed by Jester, the name referred to in Buddhist texts, blah, 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 Sabah. Okay. Main duty of the king was to protect the tribe. Purohita, the chaplain, Senani, the Sena, the army.
Brahmins
and kshatriyas
in such a kettle, the common woman,
right?
All
the
Punsachali, yeah.
We're talking about the early Vedas who are wandering about, are we? This is before they settled down.
Yeah, we're talking about the early Vedas, yeah. Yeah, possibly that's what I meant. I mean, in you have, I'm not sure where that's come from. I'm not sure what that's based on, but you do find in the Mahabharata, the central theme of the Mahabharata is four or five brothers who share a common wife. So perhaps that's from there. King and Floyd's.
Do that in
Tibet too. Yeah. Okay.
It's when you have limited resources or goods. And then that factory meal.
Yeah.
But it means that the land is not divided up amongst sons.
Uh-huh.
Because one woman, I mean, there's only one old son if you have one wife.
Yeah.
So say you've got four, right? Yeah. It sort of preserves the land, because you don't have one woman, only have a certain number of children in the life. Married to four men.
Yeah, so gender is a far phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's one thing, but the other thing is that whatever their goods are, it can only be divided up amongst the number of offspring. So it's a good, really good measure of way of controlling the population when you have limited resources.
Mm. Okay. This is the Vedic Society. Yeah, so this is the old strata of the Vedic Society. Concept of Varna, class, of course, evolved into the caste system. The rules of marriage were rigid, as evidenced from various Vedic verses. Notice that's from the later period of the Vedas, the verse. Status of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas was higher than that of the Vaishyas and Shudras. Brahmins specialised in creative poetry, preserving the sacred text and carrying out various types of rituals.
When you say the later Vedic Vedas, how later are they?
Look, I mean, it's all speculative, but, 800 BC?
Okay, so that's still before the Buddha.
Oh, yeah.
So, but when we're describing the Vedic people, all of their habits and their culture and structures, that's all inferred from the Vedas, the texts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you think about, the way texts work, it could have been, say, from one very, very narrow geographical region where a few guys just came up with a few verses that kind of reflected what was going on in their narrow geographical region, but didn't at all reflect what was going on around them.
Yeah.
And that's been preserved over time. The rest of the book has been preserved.
Yeah.
Then we're referring back to this entire region.
And the horror-inducing thing is, what if they were the Scientologists? Like, seriously, we don't know. Maybe they were the, maybe it's the verses of, the inspired verses of L. Ron Hubbard is what we've actually got, But, look, I think it's a bit better than that. The Vedas, there's 10,000 verses in the Rig Veda. So it's not so narrow. It's a fairly expansive text, and it's obvious, you can tell it's created over a long period of time and things like that. So, you've got a bit more of a broad base than that. But the problem remains, certainly not a problem. Proper enunciation, it's intellectual, but it is important that the notion of the poetry, the verses, as an intellectual stimulus. Intellectual leaders, they restricted social mobility between the varnas. So in this way, this is this notion of order that I mentioned before. So they're creating a hierarchical and structured society. As opposed to a tribal society, much simpler tribal society, which tends to be very egalitarian. So you have to think of it in terms of the evolution of societies. If you've just got a very simple tribe, you know, everyone's basically the same. No one's got anything that everybody else doesn't have. No one's got knowledge that other people don't have. Here, they're starting to create that idea. No, we can specialise a certain class of people that can do this. The text, the poetry, and the rituals and the religions is becoming too specialised. It's exactly what we were doing with the work period this morning. Yeah? We're starting to say the monastery is becoming too complex. We have to actually specialise. Certain people do certain tasks. And so they're trying to do that. But in the manner of ancient peoples, they did that by using the mythology and the ritual, which would establish appropriate roles for people's function within the culture.
Is there anything stopping us from doing that, Bhante?
There's nothing stopping us from doing that.
So we can use mythic structures to...
We can, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah. The proper enunciation of verses in ritual was considered essential for prosperity and success in war and harvests. Kshatriyas, so these two things, war and harvests, death and life. Kshatriyas amassed wealth, cattle, and many commissioned the performance of sacrifices, helped in administering the polity, maintained structure of society and economy of the tribe, maintaining law and order, a ceramic goblet, which presumably is perhaps hypothesized to belong to the Vedic period. Perhaps a goblet that held the soma in.
So the
Vedic
period was it 3,000 BC?
Sorry?
The Vedic period, was that meant to be 3,000?
No, the Rig Veda is usually situated in the second millennium BC. Cattle, families, patrilinear, people prayed for the abundance of sons. Society was strictly organized in a system of four varna. Religious practices were a precursor to modern Hinduism, and so on and so on. The rishis, the composers of the hymns, were considered inspired poets and seers, understood to be hearers of an internally existing Veda. Shrata means what is heard. The mode of worship was performance of sacrifices, which include the chanting of Rig Vedic verses, singing of samans, and mumbling of offering mantras. Okay, people offered for abundance of rain, cattle, sons, long life, and gaining heaven.
Do you find the interesting things, say, compared with some other early civilizations? It's very male. I mean, it's all about the. It's all relating to men. I mean, I'm praying for the sons. I read in Karen Armstrong's Transformation. I don't know if it was her, she was quoting somebody else, but the sort of emergence of this Arab culture and the native people. I can't remember where I read it. Yeah, I read it in Karen Armstrong, but they actually had a horse, and that's what gave them. And that, I don't know if they were the original trainers of horses, but it gave them this incredible mobility and strength, so that it actually, so they were able to subdue the agrarian societies and cultures and villages.
Yeah.
And so they sort of had that switch, and they were able to go in and plunder and carry away and
yeah.
And all of the cultures that were based on this sort of incredible ability that they had to move very, very swiftly. And I thought at the time how incredible it was that simple thing should have such an incredible, profound effect both on here on their culture and basically on the world.
Mm.
If Indian culture and religion is based on this originally on these people, and is also most of Europe. It's incredible. And all those myths that are the religion that gives so much credence to
borrowed authority.
Yeah, no, to hierarchical structures, basically, and to, I mean, the role of women is just nothing.
They had sons.
Yeah, they had sons. the Brahmins, there was literally, it was divided into four castes, and the Brahmins had obviously had the had control of the the texts and all the knowledge, and I'm assuming that the Brahmin women didn't do any of that.
Yeah, quite likely.
It just is at every level.
But and of course, what we know from the texts, and assuming they're written by the man, then it's the man's voice that we hear. But what the voice that we don't hear, but definitely did exist at some time, are all the voices that we don't hear.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily mean they didn't have power, they didn't have a role, and they weren't important. It's just that we don't hear their voices.
Yes, but having a voice is incredibly important.
Yeah, but it's mainly simply that it's not a voice that we hear now. It could be heard in a different way.
But the results of this religion and culture, we do hear now. It's here. And it's in India, and it's in Australia, it's in Europe. It's not as if... Oh, that's how I see it anyway. I mean, it all sort of filters through in one way or another. Anyway.
And you see the...
I found it quite disturbing that whole of our culture, the foundations of our culture, are based on this bunch of sort of horsemen rampaging across the middle of Europe at one time. Anyway, that's... Sorry for the digress.
Thanks
a lot. I find it, very, very interesting and very important.
It is, yeah. And you see a strong emphasis in the Vedic gods, by no means exclusive, but strong emphasis on the sky gods, who tend to be very kind of ephemeral, the gods of the storms, the Maruts, the Agni, the winds, the Zeus, the gods of the sky and the thunder. So these are kind of moving fast and always kind of up there, as opposed to the kind of very slow moving, kind of imminent goddesses of the earth, tend to be the earth goddesses. And
also they're sort of rubbish, unpredictable.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Like a storm appears from nowhere. You can imagine the Aryan tribes people appearing from nowhere on their chariots. Yeah.
It must have been frightening.
Yeah. Yeah. The wolves. Yeah. The berserkers.
Just on the horse thing. I had a friend sitting up on New Year's Eve at the Botanical Gardens with thousands of other people. Just people everywhere. And then the police came and they wanted to get people around. There's only half a dozen police on horseback. And you're saying, oh, because there's just too many. But the police were slowly coming through on horses. Just basically everyone just moved. So that they were immediately just so dominant.
Interesting, yeah.
Because they were on horseback.
Yeah.
And they were just slowly moving on through.
Yeah. You know, they weren't slashing heads off or anything like that.
Get
out of here. Their arms. Get out of here, you hippies.
It was.
Absolutely, yeah. It was. It was the Blitzkrieg. They invented Blitzkrieg, right? Absolutely. And this whole idea of the sky, of divinity being located in the sky, is also something that comes from this period. And so you have Agni is the one who transforms something from matter into spirit. Yeah? So this kind of whole abstracting tendency can be seen from here as well. Sorry, Jim?
Well, I was just thinking about this
experience
I had in India when I was in a village, a very small village, and actually quite far out from the village. And I was standing in the Indian men that was there. go from a devotee.
In the home, yeah.
Yeah, and I just found it very, Ayodhya Nanda has talked to the lost feminine in the room. It's not lost, you know, like having this recording of voices, the structure of like sound waves on the structure. So things do operate in a lot of ways. You know, these forces, these powers that disappear because of the patriarchal structure, which is not necessarily. It's not destruction because that other side isn't represented in this text, but it's completely subverted.
Okay.
Another example would be, like, it's quite obvious if you looked at that from a political perspective. My father had the rule of the house, but if I think about the actual influences of my personality and the way I am, at the very least, my mum had just as much influence on the way I am as my dad, if not more, probably some more.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So there's different like, modes of influence in the way that it manifests. Mm. Yeah.
And I think that there's a masculine way and a female way of doing things, in that there's different ways of that there's power and different ways that there's inequality between the both genders, and that they do things differently.
Mm.
That's all true.
But that doesn't justify
it. It is true.
Yes.
When you see when you see it's written down in the text and then the official story, it's released.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, everybody can.
She says
so you're saying the woman directs the attention.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The guy can think as much as he likes, but the woman will determine where he's going to be looking.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. So some of the deities in the Vedic pantheon, we've already met some of these in the Indo-European pantheon. Indra, Agni, the sacrificial fire, Soma. Some deities of social order such as Mitra, Varuna, Ariman, Bhaga, Ansa, Surya, the sun, Vayu, the wind, Prithvi, the earth. Goddesses include Ushas, the dawn, Prithvi, and Aditi. Rivers, especially Saraswati, were also considered goddesses. Deities were not all powerful. The relationship between humans and deity was one of transaction, with Agni, sacrificial fire, taking the role of messenger between the two. So strong traces of common Indo-Iranian religion remain visible, especially in the Soma cult and fire worship. Ashwamedha horse sacrifice has parallels in the 2nd millennium BC under Novo culture in Roman Old Ireland. It was continued in India until at least the 4th century AD and revived under Jai Singh in 1740. The Ashwamedha is a completely, totally, utterly outrageous horse sacrifice, where you get a horse and you don't just kill it. You get this horse and you release it and follow it for a year. Okay? And wherever the horse goes for a year, you claim as your land. Right? So it can only be done by kings who are very self-confident, because if a horse wanders onto a neighboring kingdom, you're at war. Right? And the horse, you either have a very big place to start with and hope the horse doesn't wander too much, and you follow it round, and then at the end of that you sacrifice the horse, and then you have this completely pornographic ritual where the chief queen gets under a rug with this dead horse, and you can read about it if you like, but she does with it, and she has this kind of bawdy dialogue of joking and stuff with the chief priest about what she's actually doing there under the blanket with the old horse. It's completely outrageous. But they actually used to do it in ancient India. It says apparently revived under Jai Singh in 1740.
1740?
I'm not sure. Could be a say. Okay, so the Vedic religion evolved into the Hindu paths of yoga and Vedanta, and so on. Vedanta interpreted the Vedic pantheon as a unitary view of the universe with God or Brahman, seen as immanent and transcendent in the forms of Ishvara and Brahman. These post-Vedic systems support, along with later texts like the Upanishads, epics, have been fully preserved and form the basis of modern Hinduism. The ritualistic traditions of Vedic religion are preserved in the conservative Shravata tradition, blah blah. Animal sacrifice was mostly abandoned by the higher castes. By the end of the Vedic period, I don't know if that's true, animal sacrifice is still done. Remembering that all of this information is derived from the texts themselves, and you know, probably in actual fact the Pali Canon is probably the earliest actual texts that give us a fairly comprehensive idea of the social and cultural situation in India. Okay, the Vedic priesthood.
One thing, we don't have much time.
So, a class of different priests having different functions, building the altar, chanting the hymns, and so on. So, quite a developed priestly caste related down the bottom to the. There's no evidence to sustain the supposition the division of priestly functions among the Hota, Udgata, and Udvari is comparable to the Celtic priesthood. The Druids as highest priests, the Bards doing the chanting, and the Bhatis performing the actual sacrifice. There you go, just in case you're wondering. But it is quite commonly said that there are relations between the, say, the Vedic priesthood and things like the Druids and so on. Period.
So the Brahmins in the Buddhist time was sort of later Vedic type Brahmin.
That's right.
Rather than the Brahmins of today. They had more in common with these Vedic people than.
Yeah, that was. The time of the Buddha was a time of questioning.
Yeah? It was a transitional period.
It's transitional, yeah.
So they were. Had they given up. They herded cattle, I mean, originally.
Yeah.
And when did the cow become taboo or sacred?
There are some hints of that in the Pali Canon. I'm not exactly sure of the history of that.
That must have been done.
Yeah. So just to introduce the idea that there are various shakas, branches, a Hindu theological school that specializes in learning certain Vedic texts. And we're not going to talk about this for now, but just to remember the very important fact that when we're talking about the Vedic culture, Brahmanical culture, whatever, it's not a single unified system by any means, but it was being broken up into all kinds of regional things. The original basis was probably a family. Yeah, so you've got these ancient rishis who recited things, and it's probably like a family tradition to pass them down, and then that becomes like they would be the dominant families in certain regions, and so you would have different versions of the text in different regions and so on. So we typically don't necessarily have access to all of those kind of historical shakas.
Is that parallel, Bhante, in Buddhism with the reciters of the various Nikayas?
Not so much. More like the different schools of Buddhism. Yeah. It's not.
So it's not an internal division of labour?
It's not an internal division of labour, no.
Okay.
Yeah. They would have had different versions of the same text. Something like different schools having different versions.
Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons.
Yeah, different Christian schools have different Bibles as well. Okay, so just briefly summarise the Rig Veda, verses of knowledge of praise in Greek. Some of the verses still recited at Hindu prayers, religious functions, and other occasions. Okay, so one of the oldest religious texts in continued use. Okay, so we've read that basic information. So 10 mandalas, or groups of texts, totaling about, I think, 10,000 verses. Okay, so it's just the structure of it. So quite a complex structure accumulated over many times. The Shakala has 1,017 regular hymns. Okay, and the one containing 10,000 riks, presumably verses. Okay, and then these are the rishis. So remember, we read this list in the sutta just the other day, and quite a lot of similarity actually. The Angiras, the Vasishtha, Vashimitra, Kagu, Kashyapa are all, Bharata are all found in those, probably some others. And so these are, have particular verses ascribed to them according to the tradition. Okay, so these are the numbers of verses ascribed to them. The Buddha typically said to belong to the Angiras, or related to the Angiras family in some way.
Is that numbers of verses?
Numbers of verses, yeah. Okay. So, we're running out of time, so we can't do too much on all of those things. Kuru Kingdom. What is this? The position of the Kuru Kingdom. These are just some of the cultures. So this is pottery. So we mentioned before that there's very little archaeological evidence. One of the few things that we do have is some pottery of different kinds. Painting grey work, this is not in India. Andranova, isn't it? Andranova. Okay, and so just to finish up, we'll just have a look at one more Rigvedic hymn. We started out with this one to the Vishvadevas. And this is in book 6 of the Rig Veda. So this is one of the old books, and to the Vishvadevas. And let's have a look at this one here in book 1, also to the Vishvadevas. And this may be giving us some idea of some of the changes through the Vedic period, book 6 being an old book, book 1 being one of the later books. It's been quite a long one, so I might not read the whole thing. Benignant, beneficent priest with eld grey colour, the brother midmost of the three is lightning. The third is he whose back with oil is sprinkled. So I think this is the oldest brother is grey, the middle brother is lightning, the third brother whose back is sprinkled with oil. Here I behold the chief with 7 male children, 7 to the one-wheeled chariot yoke the courser, bearing 7 names the single courser draws it. 3 nave the wheel is sound and undecaying, whereon are rested all these worlds of being. So this is kind of a level of cosmological abstraction we didn't find in the previous one. We've got a wheel turning with all the worlds of being resting upon it. 7 who on the 7-wheeled car, don't know how you, Chandra, if you can design a 7-wheeled car for us, that would be good.
That's a steering wheel,
mounted, have horses, 7 in tail who draw them onward, 7 sisters utter songs of praise together in whom the names of the 7 cows are treasured. So, I mean, this is suggesting that perhaps the women did have a ritual role there, singing songs of praise. Who hath beheld him as he sprang into being, see how the boneless one supports the bony. Possibly a reference to, or it could be a reference to the evolution of life. The embryo doesn't have bones and the later person has bony, but more likely perhaps the idea that the earth rests upon the ocean, where the blood of earth, the life, the spirit, who may approach the man who knows to ask it? unripe in mind, in spirit, undiscerning, I ask of these, the gods, established places, for up above the yielding calf, the sages, to form a web their own seven threads have woven. I ask unknowing, again this keep emphasizing, I'm the one who doesn't know. I ask those who know, the sages, as one ignorant for the sake of knowledge. We find some very similar kinds of phrases in the Solasapanha, which is one of the earliest and most Brahmanically influenced of the Buddhist passages. What was that one who in the unborn's image hath stabilized and fixed firm these world's six regions? Again, this very philosophical conception here. What is that one thing which everything is based on? Let him who knoweth presently declare it, these lovely birds' securely founded station, forth from his head the cows draw milk, and bearing his vesture with whom their foot have drunk the water. The mother gave the sire his share of order with thought. At first she wedded him in spirit. She, the coy dame, was filled with dew prolific. With adoration men approached to praise her. Yoked was the mother to the boon cow's carpole. In the dank clouds, rows of cloud, the infant rested. Then the calf lowed, and looking upon the mother, the cow who wears all shapes in three directions. So a bit hard to work out all the kind of allusions here, but anyway. Of stars, could well be, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, formed by with 12 spokes, could well be a reference to the months by length of time, unweakened rolls round the heaven.
Mm.
This wheel of during order, in fact, probably is there, yeah. Mm. It's the 12 spokes of the months turning in the heaven. Hereby established, joined in pairs together, 700 sons and 20 stand, O Agni. They call him in the farther half of heaven the sire five-footed. Dad with 5 feet, 12 forms, wealthy and watery shore. So you can see something of the kind of the exuberant imagery that you get in the Hinduism is sort of coming up here. And the wheel is obviously very important. Upon this five-spoked wheel revolving ever, all living creatures rest and are dependent. Again, like the wheel of life idea. Its axle, heavy laden, is not heated. The nave from ancient time remains unbroken. The wheel resolves, unwasting with its felly, 10 draw it yoked to the far-stretching carpole. The sun's eye moves, encompassed by the region, on him dependent rest all living creatures. Of the co-born, born together, they call the seventh single-born, the six twin pairs are called the rishis, children of God. So you typically have the seven rishis. Here it's saying there's six pairs and one seventh. Their good gifts, the sort of men, are arranged in order due and various in their form move for the Lord who guides. So I'm not sure what Annie's going to make of the next verse. They told me these were males, though truly females. He who hath eyes sees this, the blind discerns not. So it's the world's first trainees, it looks like.
What?
Trainees.
For the sake of the recording, Bhante, could you explain that?
I have to say we have to finish.
Oh well, you can finish. I'm going to keep on going. Beneath the upper realm, above this lower, bearing her calf at foot, the cow hath risen. Okay, so. Okay, then we have this verse down here, which is one of my favourites. Two birds with fair wings, knit with bonds of friendship, in the same sheltering tree have found a refuge. One of the two eats the sweet fig tree's fruitage. That's the Bodhi tree. The other eateth not, regardeth only. So this is Ajahn Brahm's knower and the doer. One bird is the doer, one's just watching. There's my painting downstairs, Jana did for me. That this image is found constantly repeated in the Brahmanical literature. The tree on which the birds eat the sweetness, where they all rest and procreate their offspring, upon its top, they say, the fig is luscious. So here we come back to, again, this was mentioned in the previous one, Dyas is my father, my begetter. Kinship is here, this great earth is my kin and mother. Between the widespread world halves is the birthplace. The father laid the daughter's germ within it. So this idea of the sky father and the earth mother, the child appearing between those two. What thing I truly am, I know not clearly. Mysterious, fettered in my mind, I wander. When the firstborn of holy law approached me, then of this speech I first obtained a portion. So I think it means that in his doubts or uncertainty, when he heard of the speech, which would be the Vedas themselves, then he first gets some knowledge, sort of seems to be saying. It gives him some clarity. And this coming back now to this whole thing of knowledge, who knows this? We didn't see this in the previous one, it was more just this straight kind of praise. This one is much more doubting, much more reflective, introspective, yeah? It's quite a different kind of attitude. Before it was just this very kind of, you know, straightforward glory and, you know, very Hillsong. Sorry?
It's the other one, an earlier.
Yeah,
one.
The earlier one. This is the later one, yeah?
And this is from a different book.
It's the same book. It's from the a different book of the Rig Veda, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, moving towards that reflective consciousness in the Upanishads.
Is it the same language? Like it's the same. They're translating the same.
More or less. More or less, yeah. Again, this one being later, so being slightly changed.
No, but I mean, is this an advancement of the understanding of our ability to understand what's written, or an advancement of the actual thing?
No, the English translation is the same, yeah. It's the same translator at the same time, yeah. And this also very important verse here. They call him Indra, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, and his heavenly noble-willed Garutman. To what is one, the sages give many a name. They call it Agni, Yama, and Mata, Rishvan. Yeah? So this is quoted countless times in Hinduism. It's almost like the basic phrase of Hinduism, that the reality, the truth is one, but the sages call it by many names. Yeah. Out in four dimensions. Yeah, the Brahmins who have knowledge know them. They keep in close concealment, cause no motion of speech. Of speech, men speak only the fourth division. So the Brahmins have the first three in secret, and the rest of people only have the fourth part of speech. Some ideas, some background for the Vedic culture. Next week we'll have a look at the Upanishads.